Welcome to the very first episode of What Exactly Am I Watching Here? A proud member of the Overthink Podcast Network. I'm your host for now, Jason Helms, and I'm joined by my willing guinea pig, Dominique Lang. Say hi, Dom.
Hi, Jason.
Hey, good to have you here. Before we begin, a quick introduction to the show. What Exactly Am I Watching Here is a podcast that features an expert, myself, and a novice, Dom.
Myself.
Watching one of the great shows of television history. Deadwood, Mr. Robot, The Wire, Breaking Bad, The Leftovers, Fargo. What do they have in common? Two things. First, they're all possible features for future episodes of our podcast. And second, they were all heavily influenced by Twin Peaks. So, what better place to start? I'm a huge Twin Peaks fan, and I found out that Dom had never watched it, so I'm really excited to get his reactions to it. So whether you're a newbie like Dom, or such a fan that you know what Coop's favorite flavor of chewing gum is, I think you're going to enjoy listening to us make our way through the entire show. We'll start today with a few quick intros of who we are, then we'll get to Dom's initial reactions to the first few episodes of Twin Peaks. We'll go episode by episode, then break down some of the main characters and themes. Finally, we'll let you know what we're watching next, so you can watch along with us. And I've talked enough. So, Tom, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, Jay, thanks for guiding me through these Twin Peaks. My name is Dominic again, and I am a writer and video editor and longtime story lover. All forms of storytelling and TV, especially growing up, and really attracted to kind of more the serialized long-form storytelling. And one of the, I'd say, like, kind of touch points that a lot of writers and showrunners, for many of them, they always reference Twin Peaks. They reference David Lynch.
Yeah.
They reference the impact that this particular show had on them. But I never went back and watched the show. I knew it was kind of a cult favorite, a kind of like, again, touchstone of early 90s TV, but I never ventured into that show. But figure with a good guide such as yourself, I feel like I'm in good hands. So I'm ready to go.
Well, I'm happy to guide you. I did not watch Twin Peaks when it originally came out. I'm Jason. I teach all kinds of stuff at TCU. I'm in the English department, but I teach classes on comic books, video games, ancient Greek rhetoric and philosophy, all kinds of cool stuff. Never had a chance to teach any Twin Peaks, but hopefully at some point I will.
Yeah. It feels like with all the stuff you do teach, Jason, that you would have taught something about Twin Peaks already.
Yeah, it should line up. I'm sure I've referenced it at some point, maybe just started dancing backwards in the middle of class.
Yes.
Something nice light reference like that.
Nice light jazz that was started playing. And you just start dancing away.
I do always teach with light jazz in the background. That's kind of standard for me, just snapping along.
Totally.
I started watching Twin Peaks in the early 2000s, actually. I was aware of it when it came out. I was 9 when it first aired. I got into it in college and grad school and actually watched it on VHS. At the time, that was the Video Droid in Mill Valley. That's where I got it from.
Dang.
Worked my way through, got all the way up to 2 episodes from the season 2 finale, right before it was canceled, and then could never finish them because I knew once I did, then the show was done. And as long as I held off on those last 2, the show was still alive.
That is so sweet.
I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And so then the show came back. And in getting excited for it coming back, I decided I got to go, you know, catch up, went back, saw the episodes I'd never seen, saw the movie that they made, Fire Walk With Me, read the entire secret history of Twin Peaks that came out in between.
There's a secret history?
Yeah. Don't worry, I'll reference it in between.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah.
Good.
Get there. And I've been watching the new show on Showtime.
Okay.
And I'm so thrilled by the new show. I loved the old show, but for me, it was such a nostalgia, just a fun thing. It's so quirky. It's so weird. One of the great things I heard recently, Andy Greenwald said this on The Watch. He said, Twin Peaks was unlike anything before it when it came out, and it shaped television for the next 20 years.
Mm.
He said, when Twin Peaks came back, it is now, again, unlike anything on television before it. It's wow. This new season is completely new. And he said, I wonder to what extent it's what television will look like for the next 20 years. You know, how is it changing those things?
Okay.
And I love that line. I was like, yes, that's it. And so I'm excited for you to get to the new season. Excited for you to get through all this stuff. But that's a little bit about why I care so much about this stuff.
Yeah. That's beautiful, man. I'm really excited now.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I'm excited for you.
Yeah, good, good.
And excited for me. As I went back and watched these episodes, I watched them with my wife, and I had a blast just getting to watch her react to it, seeing these things again. It's one of those things. I mean, it's a mystery, so of course it's better on the rewatch, right?
Yes.
You know what's going to happen. You're like, ooh, I can see why that person's acting this way. I know what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that fun little hindsight advantage that you have.
Yeah. So let's jump into reactions. For today's episode, we watched the first four episodes of the first season of Twin Peaks. So what'd you think?
Yeah. So coming into the show, I mean, the central mystery is who killed Laura Palmer. I mean, Laura, she's dead in the first, 3 minutes, right out of the gate. And we are introduced to a lot of the Twin Peaks residents really fast, one after the other. And I guess my initial reactions, just trying to make sense of where we are. And
yeah,
not so much in the sense of geography, but just in the sense of tone.
Yeah.
Because there are moments where it feels very intentionally comedic, times where it feels very intentionally dramatic or even melodramatic,
mm-hmm.
and this broad, extreme emotionality for a character. And times where it feels like heavy drama or like horror even.
Yeah.
Overall, it feels like we're just in a strange, surreal place. When it comes to mystery shows and when it comes to kind of a whodunit, I am very much just along for the ride, as opposed to like a theorist of like, oh, it's got to be X person or it's got to be this one because they're acting this way. I'm more just sitting back and letting the storyteller guide. And so, yeah, so those are my kind of initial reactions. There are certain characters I love and I'm having just a blast with. Certain characters I have more of an intrigue. There are some that just annoy me. And so I'm just wondering, maybe there's a point to them or a reason they're acting this way. So they run the gamut.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm really interested to see where this show goes and how it explores the town.
Yeah. And I'm going to ask you at the end of the podcast to give me some ideas of where you think we're headed.
Okay.
Some of your, not necessarily theories, but just some ideas, where might we go from here?
Nice.
As I rewatched it, something that jumped out to me is the quirkiness, the mystery, the horror, all of these different things. And the extent to which there's a lot of ambivalence. Mm. It's going in, two drastically different directions at once, but full steam ahead in both directions.
Yeah. I was more tired watching these episodes than I was say an episode of Stranger Things, which has a more consistent tonality.
Yes. Yes.
And so watching this show where one scene is it has the 50s light snappy jazz, and then we pull a left turn into deep melodrama, and then we pull another turn into mystery or an interrogation with Cooper and Truman. And so by the end of it, by the end of an episode, you're feeling I truly have no idea where I'm going next. So in that sense, the episodes go by fairly quickly. It never feels slow to me. It always feels odd. I can never predict, one scene's going to lead into this thing. But it never feels, never bored. If that's a good thing, I don't know yet.
Yeah, no, I completely get that. And it's on Lynch's part, from what I can tell, it's 100% genuine.
Okay.
He's really interested in the dark half of the human soul. When he's doing this horror stuff, it's not just for gimmicks. He wants to know, what is this darkness within all of us? And when he's got the 50s nostalgia stuff, it's because that's a time period that shaped his life, and he's kind of interested in it. He loves it. It's really a cool, fun thing to him.
Yeah.
When people are snapping, when there's bikers and greasers hanging out for some reason in 1990, it just, for him, it makes sense, and it works, and it's his vision of the world. That's one of the things I really like about it, is it's not – these directions only make sense for David Lynch, and he helps us make sense of them in a weird way. We're just watching Lynch.
Yeah, it very much feels like we are in a dreamscape.
Yeah.
Like, in terms of watching contemporary television, one of the great, like, detriments of, like, not say over-educated audience, but, like, an audience that knows, like, okay, there's a mystery. Are they going to solve it? When are they going to solve it? What does it mean? And so the need for every mystery to be answered or every unknown thing to be known, I think, has soured a lot of viewing experiences and a lot of stories in general. And so even small things that can be just taken as characteristics, you know, like Nadine, like, I don't particularly care why Nadine has an eye patch.
Right.
Like, I know that she has this like obsessive compulsive disorder. I know that she has this like strange pursuit of silent drape runners.
We're going to be millionaires.
Yes. Which, you know, I need drape runners on my windows. So yeah. Who knows, Nadine? I might be a customer soon and very soon.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, yeah, but like those mysteries for me just further enhance character, as opposed to like, oh, this is one more question that I need to have answered by the end of the show. Otherwise, it's not a good show. Like,
and this is a show. You're absolutely right. It's a mystery. But it's not a mystery in the sense of a secret that we need to find out.
Yeah.
It's a mystery that's going to, throughout, anytime anything gets solved, three new things are going to get introduced that are going to be more puzzling. Mm-hmm. They're not always going to be a murder. Sometimes it's, you know, what's going on with Nadine's eye patch?
Yeah.
But that's much less interesting than why is she obsessed with silent drape runners?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a much more interesting part of her character, you know, yeah. What's going on there? So yeah, I think the mystery aspect is a great way to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
With that, let's jump into the episodes.
Cool.
All right, so I'll read the synopsis pulled straight from Wikipedia, and then we'll just kind of talk our way through it. I just want to refresh your memory.
Cool.
So first episode, the pilot, called Northwest Passage. The small town of Twin Peaks, Washington, is shaken up when the body of high school student Laura Palmer is discovered near a riverbank, wrapped in plastic. FBI agent Dale Cooper is called by local Sheriff Harry Truman when Ronette Pulaski, schoolmate of Laura, is found wandering on a bridge and then slips into a coma. Cooper sees the connection between Laura's death and the murder of another girl 1 year earlier. After finding a piece of paper under Laura's fingernail, similar to one he found in the fingernail of the girl who died earlier, Cooper suspects that the same killer might have struck again. Meanwhile, Sheriff Truman arrests Laura's boyfriend, Bobby Briggs, who is secretly having an affair with a married woman named Shelley Johnson. Afterwards, Laura's mother has a terrifying nightmare. Whew, that's a lot.
Yes, yes. And the pilot is 90 minutes.
90 minutes. And they filmed the Red Room scene that happens at the end of episode 3. Two. Yeah, depends on how you count.
Yeah.
They filmed that at the same time as the pilot. And the original plan was, if it doesn't get picked up as a TV show, we put the Red Room at the end, and that's the dream that the mother has. That's what we see, and then the movie ends.
Dang. Wow. Right?
That's cold.
Okay.
Whew.
That is mean.
Yeah.
yeah. So initial impressions, again, trying to figure out, I guess, yeah, the main question I had was, again, not so much a concrete, like, oh, why does Cooper say the things that he says, or what's the deal behind the donut eating habit of the Twin Peaks police force. I mean, I do have questions about that, but that's for your time. But more for me, like, what are the rules of the Twin Peaks universe? And so I know that because Laura Palmer and her death, like, that's the inciting incident. I know we're going to be dealing with that, and everything is kind of churning around that central mystery. And we're learning about everyone's relation to Laura Palmer. But even then, asking, like, what are the, yeah, like, kind of the boundaries of the show, both in terms of tone and story matter? Because I know that, like, it calls to mind a little bit for me of The Twilight Zone, just in the sense of, like, a surreal place, a place where you can't quite put your finger on it, but something feels off.
Something uncanny.
Uncanny, yeah. Something, like, this isn't taking place right outside my door. This is taking place in a world not quite like mine. It yeah. looks like mine to an extent. It sounds like mine to an extent, but there's also something else going on. And so that's, for me, like, the nervousness of, okay, so how far are we going to go with this? And in what direction are we going to go with this?
No, I think that's exactly right. I think that's a great way to look at it. You're learning the rules. I like the Twilight Zone idea. And one of the things I like about it is not just the weirdness, but Twilight Zones are fables, right? Mm. They always have a moral at the end. Yeah. You're supposed to learn something, and not about space travel and aliens. Something right. about yourself, something about humanity. Mm-hmm. Similarly, the murder of Laura Palmer, while it's really important, and something that you should, it's not just a MacGuffin in the sense that, you know, they don't actually care about it.
Okay.
It is important, and yet there are tons and tons of fables. And I really think Twin Peaks is a show of fables. It is about our universe. It's about us. It's about the darkness, the love, the hope, all those character things within us, in the world that we know. And this is another way to kind of test out those ideas, similar to Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Play them out in huge melodramatic ways. You know, so much of it is playing on soap operas.
Yeah.
Some of it is riffing.
Yeah, they have that soap opera kind of recurrent throughout the show. I think it's called Invitation to Love.
Invitation to Love.
And I almost imagine that there is somebody on that show watching Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. It almost felt like that could happen.
Yeah.
And when
we get introduced to Maddie Palmer, right? Laura's identical cousin.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you noticed this. It's the same actress.
I did not notice that. But that's...
I love that they get away with it. And the greatest thing is, and Megan didn't notice either, because she's got brown hair, now she's got glasses. It's literally her.
Oh, wow.
And the greatest thing about it is, when she comes in,
mm-hmm.
Leland Palmer is watching Invitation to Love.
Yeah.
And it's a credit sequence, and it says, and playing Emerald and Jane.
Oh, that's right.
Two figures, and it's like the corniest soap opera thing ever. Oh, you have one actress playing two different roles.
Yes.
They're twins, or it's a coincidence. They're doppelgangers.
Yeah.
And then to do it right then, it's so good. And the fact that he even still gets away with it, where you and Megan both didn't notice.
Yep.
Oh my gosh, the key figure, the person we're all caring about, the mystery we're trying to solve, she just walked in the door.
Had no idea.
It's so good.
Oh, that's fantastic.
We've talked a little bit about the rules. Started talking about a little about the soap opera nature. I think there's a real tension in this first episode, also between TV and film. It's got a lot of TV tropes in it, and yet it's also bucking those tropes. It feels like really hard in other ways.
Yeah, I definitely feel that, and it's, I think, again, how one scene tonally exists in one place and then another scene tonally exists in a whole other space. There's also a lot of scenes that begin where people are just finishing an activity.
Yeah.
Or like they are not quite like in the middle of a different conversation, but something else is happening and then the scene begins.
Yeah.
If you ever take a screenwriting course, one of the main things that is taught is get into the scene as fast as possible and leave as fast as possible. And so, like, if the scene's an interrogation, just, like, begin right away, end as soon as the interrogation's over. Whereas, like, with Twin Peaks, it's hard even to give an example, but you are starting in another space, and then we kind of, like, find our way into this interrogation, and then something else happens, and then we, like, jump tones and jump characters into somewhere else. And yep. So you can never quite predict where we're going to go. Like with TV mysteries, there's a body in the first couple of minutes. You assemble your suspects. There's an arrest at the halfway point. There's a trial. There's a twist at the end. The killer is confirmed. And then everybody goes home and goes to bed at 42 minutes.
Right.
But yeah, Twin Peaks very much does away with that formula.
There's no procedural nature at all. It's not just that we're not going to find the murderer at the end of each episode. It's that each episode is going to be structured completely different.
Yes.
From the previous one.
Mm-hmm.
Part of this is Mark Frost and David Lynch teaming up. Mark Frost is a TV writer.
Oh.
That's his pedigree.
Okay.
And then David Lynch is into not just film, but surreal film.
Yeah.
In the most literal sense. That's literally, the kind of style he does mm-hmm. is surrealist film. And yet he's somehow also popular, somehow accessible.
yeah.
So it's that minute and a half intro, right? You've got the theme song, the credits, all that. It's a full minute and a half long.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way you get away with that these days.
No.
But even at the time, I wonder to what extent people would have pushed back.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's so pure Lynch.
Yeah.
Now when I watch the new series, they've got a slightly different opening credits.
Oh.
But it's very similar.
Okay.
It's the same song. It lasts about the same length. Instead, now it's reminding you of the original series and reminding you that it's different.
Yeah. Okay.
I watch it every time.
Yeah.
And I watch it every time because it gets me in the mood. It connects me. It's my shifting gears moment from whatever I was watching to, okay, now I got to go be in David Lynch's mind for a second. Let's see how this goes.
Yeah. That's good because, and I think that's a good convicting point because I watched it in full the first time, but have skipped it ever since.
Yeah.
And again, like I watch it with the lens of a modern TV viewer of like, is this essential for me because it reveals a piece of the puzzle? No, then okay, I can skip it.
Yeah.
As opposed to like opening credits were designed as introductions to the world itself.
Yeah.
And like the space you were going to be in. And that's a very filmic trope as well. Like opening credits were minutes long. There was like a whole, especially in like longer musicals, there was an opening song or a prologue. So yeah, it is an introduction to that universe. I think it's a very wise point.
How much Lynch have you watched?
I've seen, funny enough, the only movie I've seen from Lynch is The Elephant Man, which
okay.
I suppose is one of his most straightforward or kind of like more non-surreal.
Yeah.
Films.
Yeah. Surreal moments, but
yeah.
Certainly it's got a plot,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
You can hang with it. There are characters. I get what's happening.
Totally. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was tremendous. But that was it.
His eye is just incredible. I love how he composes shots.
Yeah.
I think it's really beautiful. Especially his sense of sound. He's actually done a few, albums, and produced various albums. Yeah. He's very into ambient music, jazz. He even did a cool team up with Trent Reznor for something a while ago. Like he's an interesting cat.
Okay. Okay.
He's also super into transcendental meditation.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
When I think I forget which episode get into it, maybe. But when
Zen or the skill of to catch a killer, something like that.
So when Cooper opens his bag of tricks as to how he discerns, he's like, I want to talk to you a little bit about Tibet.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, okay. Let's do that.
Let's go there.
Let's go.
Yeah. Lynch has a book. It's like basically a self-help book for struggling creatives. Called Catching the Big Fish.
Huh.
And it's basically about transcendental meditation.
Okay.
It's a great book. It's really fun. Get the audiobook because he reads it in his great, kindly Midwestern voice.
Wow.
The first time I realized that Laura Palmer had to be brutally murdered. It's amazing. He's such a kindly person in so many ways. And then this stuff will just come out about the darkness of the human soul and you're like, what?
Wow.
Yeah. It's a fun little book that I did as an audiobook. So yeah, that's part of it. He's looking for connections. We'll see a few more of them as we move forward. I'll kind of mention, here's where this came from. Nice. The first one I can tell you about is Laura Palmer was never supposed to be much of a part of the show.
Really?
She's the body at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then she's supposed to be like a void, right? That everyone talks about, but you were never going to see the actor again.
Okay.
And so he literally just cast someone from the town that they were filming in and just said, you know, this, we're going to save some money. We'll get somebody who's not even an actor, get her to do it. And then they decided to do the VHS tape that James has.
Yes.
And so she did the VHS tape, and they're looking at the VHS tape afterwards. They're like, she's really good.
Yeah.
She's really interesting. She did a lot with not very much.
Yeah.
Can we get more of her? And from that, you know, the whole kind of arc changed. Now we had to have, for one thing, we can bring in her twin cousin.
Yes.
So we can actually get the actor back on. But now we can do flashbacks. We can do other things. So that we can bring her in for the dream sequence.
Yeah.
So that Lynch is very open to that. He's got a very well scripted thing, and then he's very open to changing it based on what happens.
Yeah. I guess, again, just because watching TV and reading a lot of interviews, like following showrunners and writers like Damon Lindelof or David Milch or David Simon, and the idea of like a limited series, which has become more and more popular. You watch a limited series, it does really well, and then a week later you find out, oh, they're going to do a season two. I'm interested to find out, maybe after I finish Twin Peaks, like if there was a plan of like, we're going to do a limited run, like, or this is our story, or was there a notion of just like Lynch just saying, I'm just going to explore this like mental dreamscape until I'm done.
Yeah.
And
there were tensions. I can tell you this, the goal for Lynch, was that the Laura Palmer murder would become less important over time.
Okay.
And they would care more about the town and the other mysteries that then came from it.
Got it. Cool.
And we would go those directions. And as you can imagine, the network would much prefer, can we just have a different murder every season and it gets solved at the end of every season? Like, you know, can we paint by numbers for this, get it done? And so there was some tensions there. I think that's a safe thing to say right now.
Okay.
To not spoil too much for you.
Cool.
Anything else about episode one, or I should say the pilot?
No, I think that about covers it for me.
All right. So episode one, which is the one after the pilot, also called episode two, depending on what you're looking at, but it's Traces to Nowhere. Cooper's investigation into the murder of Laura Palmer continues as her secret boyfriend James Hurley is interrogated, and it appears that both trucker Leo Johnson and Laura's psychiatrist Dr. Jacoby may have some connection to the crime. Laura's best friend Donna and Audrey Horn vow to solve the murder.
Right on. So I'd say Leo and Dr. Jacoby are two of my least favorite characters right now. Maybe that changes, but I mean, Leo is just a punk. And I think characters like Leo and forget her name.
Sarah.
Okay. So Sarah Palmer and Leo Johnson, for me, really reinforce the notion of melodrama and fable.
Yeah.
Which I'm fine with, because Sarah Palmer seems hysterical from the word go.
Like, yeah.
Even when she doesn't know that Laura's been murdered, she seems unhinged. Yeah. And the same goes for Leo. That the guy just operates on a level of unhingedness. So those are characters whose scenes I always kind of have to go like, all right, fine, I guess. If we must, we must. And so we go through that. To learn more about like how Cooper operates is really fascinating. I think Kyle MacLachlan is killing it in this stuff. I think he's fantastic. And the way he's able to balance like his fascination with the town of just like, you know, he's talking, and this might have been in the pilot or not, but when he's asking Sheriff Truman, just like, what kind of trees do you have here? And all of this. And then like the very next question or series is about the murder, and able to pivot and yet feel like, he's like, this is all within Agent Cooper. So again, like that oddness and exploration of a person, I just like, I always enjoy anything that McLaughlin is doing. I think he's great. And also learning, like, we're kind of getting, I guess, like little notions or breadcrumbs for each character about, okay, so this is the connection to Laura, or this is what might be going on with this character. And yeah, like starting to edge out from the initial, like, very narrow focus of Laura Palmer. Like, we're starting to kind of slowly edge our way outward.
Yeah. And so what's also happening is we've got Laura Palmer when she's first seen, you know, she's dead, and in a weird way, she's perfect.
Yeah.
Even as a corpse, she's perfect. There's a perfection there. She is the American dream.
Yeah.
Right. The cheerleader dating, she was the prom queen who's dating the quarterback.
Yeah.
Right. It's it all, you know, perfect Americana. And then as the investigation goes on, she suddenly becomes not just real, but someone with a lot of issues.
Yeah, there's someone with a lot of
secrets. Lot of things going on. You know, it starts, I think, with Dr. Jacoby saying that that he was her psychiatrist. And by the way, her parents didn't know that she was seeing me.
Yes.
And then it spirals out from there. She's got a drug habit. She may have been a sex worker. She,
yeah.
You know, this, all these other things, and finding out those threads, the mystery changes, the mystery shifts, and it becomes a little bit salacious.
Yeah. You know, like you see that Bobby is both connected to girl at the diner and Laura Palmer.
Shelley.
Yep. Thank you. Yeah. So he's him with the Shelley and Laura. And so my first reaction is like, oh, well, Bobby is two-timing and whatever. But then you also realize and come to see that, like, Laura was doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And you're right. Like, once we get into Traces to Nowhere, like, they very much chip away and, like, demythify Laura Palmer, as opposed to the pilot, where she is, like, idolized, venerated. You know, like, the town has truly lost its, like, gemstone of a human being. And Laura is far from that.
And all these other quirks are also going to be kind of quintessentially American. You know, who's she two-timing on Bobby with, but basically James Dean.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, we've got somebody who's just doing a James Dean impression. Who's he's a stand-in for James Dean. It's natural. It's perfect that way.
Yep.
So many just quaint, cute little things. I love it.
Oh yeah.
Ready to continue on to episode two.
Yeah. Let's do it.
All right. Episode two, Zen, or the Skill to Catch a Killer. Cooper tells Sheriff Truman and his deputies about a unique method of narrowing down the Laura Palmer murder suspects. Ben welcomes his returning brother Jerry with some bad news, and the two decide that a trip to One-Eye Jack's is needed. Cynical FBI agent Albert Rosenfield arrives in town. Josie discovers that Catherine is double-crossing her. That night, Cooper has a strange dream that elevates the murder investigation to a whole new level.
Yeah. So this,
and here, I want to talk about all these.
Okay, good. Yeah,
we will get to the dream. So let's hold off on that for a second.
Okay,
and make sure we kind of hit a couple of the others because this happens quick.
All right. Yes, yes.
So first sentence of that, the unique method of narrowing down the murder suspects. That is, what do you know about Tibet?
Yeah, that is unique. Doesn't even begin to describe it. So telling him about Cooper brings them all out into the woods. And I love the shot of when he flips the chalkboard and says, I want to talk to you about Tibet. All four simultaneously lean in. And it just feels straight out of like a Three Stooges routine. And so, like, I appreciate the fact that, at least in my imagination, Lynch is just like, let's just have some fun.
Yeah.
Because this is, like, there is a, again, like, that oddness to dreams. Like, nothing, like, in a natural world, nothing ever happens in, like, that simultaneous or almost like that musicality.
Yeah.
It almost feels like a musical number in a sense. And Cooper has this setup of a glass bottle on the other, you know, like 60 feet, 6 inches, which is the exact distance from pitcher's mound to the catcher in baseball, but no one ever mentions baseball. No one ever mentions like the parallel. And there are names that are listed on the chalkboard, and there's rocks, and there's oven mittens. And so just like...
I forgot about the oven mittens.
Yeah, like Hawk has to hold the bucket with oven mittens. And just like, okay, cool. Like, let's do it, man. Like, I'm in.
Yep.
So in that sense, it just felt like a lot of fun.
Yep.
And oddly enough, like at the beginning, I was just like, okay, this is just like really weird. Like, are we gonna go through all the names? And we like one by one by one by one go through. And when he hits the bottle,
yeah,
Jason, I felt something.
I love it.
Yeah, I was just like, oh, we got the bottle.
Let it be known, I hit the bottle, but it did not break.
Yes, very key.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. So this is a little bit from Zen. Again, the title of the episode. I've been practicing Zen for about a year.
Okay.
And one of the things I've learned about it is it's got a lot of rules. And depending on what school you're in, they'll have different rules.
Okay.
And what I think I've discovered is that the rules don't matter, but that it's very, very important that you have rules and that they are kind of iron rules. You live and die by these things.
Yeah.
And that they'd be fairly arbitrary, right? One important thing, for instance, when you're sitting in Zen is that the left foot is over the right when you're sitting down. Absolutely vital.
Okay.
Now, why? There's ideas behind it, but it's much more about the ritual and doing things the same way.
Yes.
And you're kind of cutting off different avenues so you can focus on just one thing.
Okay.
Why the oven mitts? We could go through a whole thing about his energy is going to infect the stones or something. It's not about that.
Yeah.
Which, it's again, about having the ritual.
Yeah, having the ritual of it. And that's, again, like, I think one of the things I so appreciate about the dreamscape, like, it reminds me so much of Fellini, and it reminds me of 8 and a half, and just that, like, that embrace of a surreal visual. And, like, not everything has to make sense. Not everything has to have an explanation, but you're right, like, that ritual and that process, there is some sort of like deeper thing working there.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's slowly, you're finding it, you're discovering it through the arbitrariness of the rules.
Mm-hmm.
So not everything has to mean something. And sometimes a baguette is just a baguette.
Yeah.
So let's continue on to Ben and Jerry.
Yes. Holy smokes. So I love the Ben and Jerry joke.
Yeah.
And I was simultaneously annoyed, and also it's one of the most hilarious for me scenes when Benjamin just becomes enamored with this baguette.
Yeah.
And the fact that you can't understand what they're talking about when he's like, you know what this, you know what this reminds me of?
Yeah.
Which again, like in a contemporary TV show, like you would never do that. You would never purposefully distort a conversation between two characters in a scene and then never explain it.
Yep.
Like, I have full confidence that we're never going to go back to that conversation.
Right. You know the content of it. There was nothing important. It was something that they had as kids.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
It was something that for some reason they also treated as though it were a dirty joke. But I don't need to know it.
Yeah.
I don't need to know the reference. I just need to join in.
Yep. Exactly. And so they go to One Eyed Jack's, which is like, I guess it's across the border.
Yep. Yep, they got to take the boat up to Canada.
It feels like a very odd, like a throwback in terms of it being a whorehouse or some kind of like thing. It feels like the 1920s. And like, yeah, no explanation as to like where, well, Jerry's, I guess he's been in France?
Yeah, sounded like it. I think that's right.
Yeah, I guess France, learning about their dynamic. It seems like Ben has always been the one in charge. And and Jerry just will follow Ben to wherever he goes. But it also seems like Ben, not only is he cheating on his wife with
Catherine
Martel, but he is also what appears to be quite a regular customer at One Eyed Jack's.
And in fact, they what we slowly discover is that One Eyed Jack's gets its girls from Ben's department store, the fragrance counter.
What a sleaze.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's revealed that Renette Blasky worked there. The way that Ben tells Jerry that there's a new girl at One-Eyed Jack's is he says, there's a new girl from the fragrance counter.
That's right. Okay. Okay.
And then it's revealed that Laura worked at the fragrance counter. She held like five jobs. Oh my gosh, she worked everywhere.
Laura was like, she was Meals on Wheels. She was a tutor. She was a tutor for Johnny, but also a tutor in English for Josie Packard.
That's right.
Like, I mean, the girl gets around physically. Like, she just goes everywhere.
And about half of the stuff is like charity work.
Yeah, you're like, oh, that's really nice. I really appreciate that, Laura. And then there's other stuff as well.
And then sneaking out for fun picnics. Like, yeah. The affairs that she's having, or the cheating that she's doing on Bobby, is a great fun picnic with her best friend and another boy.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, like, it's a very sweet cheating.
Yes. Yeah. It's cheating, but, you know, done delightfully so.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Way to go, Laura.
They've got a chaperone.
Yeah. It's okay. It's all right. No problem there.
So next, get psyched, Albert Rosenfield. Miguel Ferrer comes to town.
Woo! Love that guy. This was just fantastic. I mean, the guy comes in just with like straight in, wonderful energy. Feels very much like the big city. And he feels like, not pun intended, but like a foreign agent. Like,
yeah.
It's like if there was a character or an image that tells you you're dreaming.
Yeah. Like someone, he's like the spinning top.
Yeah, he's the spinning top like that breaks into your dream. And just like, this is a dream. Yeah. He very much feels like, oh, you're from the other show. Like, you're from the traditional, like, so what do you got from the coroner's report?
And he hangs out with Munch.
Yeah.
Him and Detective Munch, right?
Yes. Oh, wow. Richard Belzer, Law and Order.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know that Richard Belzer makes a cameo ever in Twin Peaks, but it feels like he should.
Yes.
It feels like he needs to walk in.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's what it felt like for me, is that Miguel Ferrer just came out of this like wholly other place.
Yeah.
And as much as I love him, I also, like, you get the feeling that, like, this guy's not going to last for long in this world. And going back to, like, what are the rules of this place? And going back to, like, how do we operate? It feels like Miguel, like, you almost like you had that energy and you had that, like, seasoning. But then we're going to go back to these other characters. Like, he's not someone who's going to be there forever.
Right.
Yeah.
So now on to the last bit.
Yes.
Cooper has a strange dream.
Boy, does he.
I just want to know, just gut reaction to this moment.
Yeah.
When that happened, what was that like?
So, man, when that happened, again, like, going back to my question of what are the rules of this place, that's when it felt like the answer was, there are no rules. Or, like, we're going to go wherever the dream takes us.
Yeah. I'll say it's like Zen.
Yeah.
It's like hitting the bottle. There are rules. They just make no sense.
Okay. Okay.
Right? Like we're going to get more dreams like this. That's going to happen.
Okay.
That's part of the structure now of the show. Don't worry.
It's going to happen. Okay. So the one, like, technical behind-the-scenes thing that I allowed myself to look up was how they do the line readings.
Yeah.
And that I thought was fun. Like,
did you find footage?
I didn't find footage, but I just read the technique about it, of how the actors would learn the lines backwards, recite them as such, and then, because you could hear it audio-wise, like, they would play the audio backwards.
Yeah.
Which is then, like, why everything sounds almost like a bizarre Russian dream sequence.
That gum that you liked will come back in style.
So Sometimes my arms pull back.
Bend back. And every movement that they make, they film the entire thing backwards. I mean, it's, and everything's wrong. Everything's uncanny. Which is weird because we've been talking about how the whole show is uncanny.
Yeah.
So we've got two elements. One, Albert making us remember, hey, I kind of got used to this show.
Yeah.
Because now somebody from the real world just walked in.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of sided with the show against him. I was like, no, 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 you don't belong here.
Yep. Yep.
And then the show reminded me that there's still weirder places to go.
Yes.
So that I'm in between the two. I'm not in reality, but I'm not as surreal as things can get.
Mm-hmm.
I'm somewhere in between still.
Yeah.
I think one thing, as you look back on that dream sequence and future ones,
mm-hmm.
Lynch really plays with the long cut. And so I think that's as much as he likes to do with auteur and kind of just virtuoso show off.
Yeah.
Especially for his actors. I'm going to make an actor, sit down, start in the corner, turn around, walk to a chair, talk for a bit, and then get up and dance. Mm-hmm. And what that means is if that's a 45-second sequence, the actor had to start with the dance and dance backwards to a beat that will be laid on it later.
Yes.
Sit down in the chair, but make it look like he was getting up.
Oh, man.
Then get up, but make it look like he was sitting down, and then walk backwards to the corner, mm-hmm. and then finish with another kind of little dance.
Yep.
I mean, it's phenomenal.
I thought it was really brave and really just like a lot of fun and really almost like I felt a great sense of trust. And I'll say this about just the show in general. Like I feel as a viewer very respected.
Yeah.
Because I don't feel like I am being misled or strung along. Of like, hey, remember this mystery? Like, remember this thing because it's important. Like, things are left open to interpretation because, like, you dream too. And the world doesn't make sense to you either. And, like, you know there is darkness as much as Lynch knows there is darkness. Lynch seems to be a little more comfortable exploring it. But you are nonetheless invited into it at all points. And I think that's a very admirable trait as a storyteller. Again, so like that dream sequence for me was very enticing and just like, all right, like we're going into far weirder places than I thought we were going, but hey, I'm in, let's do it.
Yep. And we've already gotten an explanation for one piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes my arms bend back.
Yes. Right?
And he learns in the very next episode that is how she was bound, mm-hmm. when she was tortured and killed.
Yes.
They bent her arms back.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're getting little pieces to say, this isn't just weird for the sake of weird.
Yeah.
You're giving me something here, and I'm supposed to try to parse it. Even if I don't succeed, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
There's a
callback to the Fire Walk With Me piece that they found at the beginning, like in the crime scene. And yeah, there's enough little pieces that connect to where like, oh, okay, like there is, again, I'm feeling like I feel respected of like, yeah, there is connection to this, but it didn't feel like the end of Lost, where like every episode was just like an index, like we're just going to answer every single question you have because apparently that's what we have to do. It felt very much like still an exploration.
Yeah, when we get to the new season of Twin Peaks, I'll connect you to an interview with Damon Lindelof about Twin Peaks and its influence on Lost and Leftovers. He's a huge Twin Peaks fan.
Nice.
And it's fun to listen to him because he's such a fanboy about it. He's just excited about it. He's like, oh, this is so much fun. I love this show. I'm so excited that it's back.
That's cool.
All right, so two other things we get in the dream.
Yes.
We get the Man from Nowhere. That's the actual name of the little person. Yep. Or, I'm sorry, the Man from Another Place. That's it. Man from Another Place. We also get two other characters, Killer Bob and Mike.
Okay.
Mike is the one-armed man, and he appeared in both of them, by the way, these are other happenstance moments.
Yeah.
These are not original.
Oh.
So the way it happened was he put the one-armed man in the hospital just for a nod to the fugitive. That was it.
Oh,
And then when he was writing the speech that he gives, the Fire Walk With Me speech, he imagined him reading it. He was like, Yoshi read this really well. And he's like, okay, well, now I've got to figure this out. Mm. Now I've got to, he's going to be playing this and he's a bigger role now. And now the one arm has to be part of it. So now this guy had a tattoo on his arm and they killed together and he had to cut off his arm so that he could stop killing.
Yeah.
And then we've got Killer Bob. Killer Bob, the guy with the long grayish hair.
Yeah. Who was in apparently just like a quick like dream something that Sarah Palmer had and apparently freaked the crap out of her.
So and he's hiding behind a bed, right? The first time she sees him.
Which, like, I don't know where the bed is. I don't know, like, what is going on. But he's there and then gone.
Well, the cool thing is you actually saw him earlier in the episode.
What?
Because what happens, he's a stagehand.
No.
And his reflection was in the mirror. And the PA looked at David Lynch and said, we can't use that shot.
Because
the stagehand's reflection was in the mirror. And he looks at the shot again and goes, oh, we're using that shot.
Yeah.
That guy is terrifying. And that's how Killer Bob came to be.
Oh my gosh. This feels like, I love the like openness with which Lynch approaches this story. Like there is not a like defiance of formality, but very much a like, oh, okay, this happens. So we'll just do this. Like we'll go that way. Like if a door cracks open, I'll just walk through the door and it's okay.
Becomes part of the story. Lynch as a director is very much, he is the stylus of the universe. The universe is writing this thing. He just happens to be there when it's getting written. He's just the pen.
Wow.
So that can work in a couple ways. One of them would be Fellini is making Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Right. Lynch, very influenced by Fellini. He couldn't have done this without Fellini. He's not just, you know, thinking like, oh, let's make this a Fellini shot. It's just, that's who he is. He's been shaped by Fellini. Many soap operas that he knew as a kid, you know, all of these different things are getting into it. But other things, he knows that he's already open to chance. He knows that chance has shaped his life and that these things are happening. So he's therefore more open to chance and just saying, if something cool happens, let's go with it and see where that can lead.
That's fantastic.
I love him. Really love Lynch. All right. So with that one, now let's go into the last episode we're covering today, episode 3, the fourth episode, Rest in Pain. Cooper tries to deduce the meaning behind his strange dream the night before. Later at the funeral of Laura Palmer, emotions explode over her grave. Norma Jennings learns that her husband Hank is up for parole. Sheriff Truman reveals to Cooper the existence of the secret society known as the Bookhouse Boys and the society's mission against the evil in the woods of Twin Peaks. Laura's cousin Maddie arrives in town.
A quick end note on the end of previous episode, Zen. I love the fact that the last scene is Cooper waking up. He calls Truman and says, I know who killed Laura Palmer. And in a mystery, if Laura Palmer was the thing that we hang our hat on every episode, then when Cooper calls Truman and says, I know who killed Laura Palmer, like we cut to black, that's the end of the episode.
Yeah.
But the fact that he says, I know who killed Laura Palmer, and then it continues and he says, no, Sheriff, it can wait till the morning. And then he starts snapping along to the same music that the man from another place starts snapping to, which was in his dream. And the whole thing, just like, man, I don't know where we're going, but that was super cool. That was great.
Yeah.
So that was just a little like, I love that.
No, that's a fantastic place to get to, because then we pick up with the next episode right from there. Now they're meeting for coffee. He sees Audrey Horne first. They have a little flirtatious interrogation. And then he tells them all the dream. He relates the entirety of the dream to them, explains pieces of it, which is great.
It's a great.
And then even tells us.
No, I was going to say it's a great balance of like, giving us a little explanation and then kind of giving us a little push into like kind of our homework or like what we were, at least in terms of Cooper, what our story or pursuit is going to be for the episode.
Yeah. So, and even the thing that we're not allowed to know.
Mm,
right? Laura mentioned, or the beautiful woman who looked exactly like Laura, the man from another place's cousin, whispered in his ear the name of the killer.
Yeah.
And he doesn't remember what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Which, one of those dream things where, like, he never heard it. Clearly, like, it never actually happened.
Yeah.
But it was a dream where you know that that's what she's whispering, but you can't quite hear it for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it's being blocked, and you'll get there in a second. All right, so relates to the dream. They're hooked.
Yeah.
But he says, if we can solve this, if we can decode this mystery, we'll know. Which is great because it gives the audience hope, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? We can solve it from here.
Yeah. Two things for me also stuck out in the episode. One was Bobby's explosion at the funeral.
Yep.
Because that seemed like a really great call out of the cracks beneath the surface of Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And the fact that, like, everybody's cheating on everyone with somebody else, that there's deception and darkness just beneath this veneer of the R, like the double R of pi, of like just all these niceties. And there's much more, I guess, there's much more viciousness that people are capable of than we're letting on to each other. And so Bobby calls that out. I thought that was fantastic.
By the way, I just got something. You just explained a joke to me that I've never gotten before.
Really?
Pi R squared.
Oh.
It's all a circle. Right? Pi at the double R.
Wow.
Holy cow.
Yeah,
never thought of that before. I don't know if that's intentional, but I love it.
Yeah.
I'm keeping it.
There you go. And then also, to your point of the goal being to expand beyond the Laura Palmer mystery, this felt very much like, I guess, like to this point, and not a bad thing, but this felt like the most kind of outside voice, like, okay, we are going to shift away now from a natural exploration of Laura Palmer. Now we have like the drug running and Bookhouse Boys and Evil in the Woods. It's like,
yep,
we sit Cooper down, who at times acts as an audience surrogate, at times is like just as much of a dream figure as anybody else.
Yep.
But here we're sat down and told, like, hey, there's evil in the woods, been this way for a long time. There's a society that deals with this.
Yeah.
And so, again, not bad. Yeah, I wasn't disappointed. I was just like, oh, all right, this feels like a deliberate shift.
Yeah. And this, the Bookhouse Boys, that's our first kind of revelation of the larger story of Twin Peaks, the town.
Yes.
Right? That there's kind of maybe an epic saga going on here.
Yeah.
So the secret history of Twin Peaks came out after it came out just before the show came back.
Oh.
It came out in November, I think, of last year.
Okay.
And it is a kind of fake dossier with all these texts by different people that's been assembled. You know, there's a letter from Nixon in it, all that kind of stuff. it's good. The first thing it has. One of the first things is a missing page from Lewis and Clark's journals.
Lewis and Clark?
Yeah. So it goes way back.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's great because Mark Frost wrote it, and he went back and he plotted out, you know, when would they have passed through the Twin Peaks area?
Yeah.
The fictional area. Now let's tell a story that would have happened at that time.
Mm.
And let's give birth to this kind of sense that there's evil in the woods, but also that there's a force of good fighting it. And you get a few other details, but like that's the basics of it. So you get this real feeling that this has been going on for a while. I'm not sure when that started for Mark Frost. We get clues as the show goes on that this is a much longer history.
Yeah.
But the secret history is the first place that a lot of it gets spelled out.
Yeah.
Different characters we've seen. We actually find out how Nadine got her eye patch. I mean, I know that you've been wanting to know.
I'm dying. It's just like that's the thing that's robbed me of sleep.
We get the secret history of the log lady.
Really? Okay.
Oh, yeah, man. Not sure you ever wanted to know, but now that I know, I related it to my wife last night saying, yo, okay, so here's the secret history. And by the end of it, yeah, I was crying a little bit.
Oh,
I'm like, yeah, I'm crying about the log lady.
Yeah,
it's fine.
Okay. All right.
So, and I don't believe any of that is ever revealed in the show.
No.
It's you got to read the other stuff. You got to get into it just because you're into it, but you don't have to enjoy the show. The show rests on there just being a larger mystery,
mm-hmm.
Which is cool.
Yeah.
One other thing I wanted to bring up about the funeral. Leland Palmer throws himself on into the grave.
He
on
does. The coffin. He does. Oh my gosh.
And that to me is like, it's maybe as important as the dream in terms of Twin Peaks' vibe, its feeling, right? It's another kind of weirdness, which is totally on the surface weirdness. It's not, you know, subliminal dreaming, you know, the unconscious. Yeah. It's just, it's embarrassing and it's funny and it's also really heartfelt.
Like, yes.
You actually feel bad for him. You understand, wow, I can't imagine what it's like to be a grieving father. All of that in that moment.
Yeah. And it was that moment coupled with the two times that Leland dances by himself.
Mm.
I know one for sure takes place at the end of Rest in Pain. I think the other one, when he's listening to Transylvania 65,000, might be in the previous episode, but
it breaks the picture.
Yeah. Like those moments, again, like Twin Peaks kind of vibe of weird and a little funny, quirky, but like heavily emotive.
Yeah.
Like whatever you're feeling, it has felt like the saturation's turned up all the way.
I like that. Yeah.
Just again, that dream notion of whatever happens, it happens in full.
Yeah,
the end of Rest in Pain, like, I really felt for Leland. Just, like, that's a man who is right now, like, in the throes of grief. And really has, like, nothing to pull him out of it.
And to have Shelley making fun of him.
Mm-hmm.
In, like, the very next scene.
Yeah.
Shelley, a character that generally we kind of liked so far.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe just because we hated Leo so much.
I think so. Yeah.
But it hurts.
Mm-hmm.
You're not laughing in that moment. It really, and it reminds you of how serious that thing was.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it was embarrassing when it happened. I'm just like, I wanted to look away. I wanted to like scrub through the scene or move on. And the fact that like, the rig breaks and it is that's funny.
It's funny.
It's darkly comic, but it's also like you remind yourself that he is resting on top of his daughter's coffin. Mm-hmm. And just like, well, that's dark.
Yeah.
Like it's just tough.
Tough. I think Shelley's almost there to correct us if we just thought that scene was funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. We've covered about 4 hours worth of television so far.
So far.
We're doing good. Let's jump into the characters then.
Cool.
All right. So each episode will focus on a few characters and themes. Today I picked three characters to talk about. And then I'm going to ask you to bring up any others you're interested in talking about. So first off, we got, of course, Special Agent Dale Cooper, then Leland Palmer, and then Laura Palmer. Quick hits on each. Give me your thoughts on Coop.
Coop is a brilliant mind, an imaginative mind. In that sense, unlike the traditional, quote-unquote, like FBI or outside eye into a strange town. Like, not at all a Matlock, Columbo archetype. Someone who is smarter and more open to what could be than, again, kind of the standard thing. Whatever scene he's in, he never feels like he's ill-prepared or not ready to go there. Wherever there is, Cooper goes with it. And I think that's very admirable. So, again, part of it is just like, I think McLaughlin's doing a great job. And also, I think Cooper's just a very well-written character right now.
That's another Zen thing also. Mind like water.
Oh.
What does water do when you throw a boulder in it? Big splash.
Yeah.
What does water do when you throw a pebble in it? Small splash. Just reacts appropriately.
Mm.
Mind like water.
Wow.
All right. Leland Palmer, hit me.
Leland Palmer. Just a big, big ball of grief right now. Just like racked with this feeling. Like I when I think of Leland, I just think of this weight that's on him. And almost it's like it feels that the more the episodes progress, the like less expressive he becomes, or the less like communicative he can be with other people.
Yeah.
Like he is sinking deeper and deeper. I don't know when the last time was that he had like a normal, a one-to-one conversation with anybody.
Yeah.
Like the last time it feels that he has a conversation might be the scene where Truman tells him Laura's dead. Like,
yeah,
I think that's
it. He talks to Benjamin Horne, like in the scene prior to that. And that's, I think, the only scene we get of him pre-breakdown.
Right. And so from there, he's just in this space. And I'm interested to see what, if anything, pulls him out of it. Like, is there, like, I don't know what's going to pull him out of it.
Right.
So far, the guy's just like sinking deeper and deeper into grief, into mourning. And I don't know what's going to happen to change that.
Yep. All right. Laura Palmer.
Man, Laura is more than the surface Americana. She is very, I guess, emblematic of the veneer of an American dream, or like an idealized persona of what we think everything has to be or look like or be. And as soon as you do a little digging, it takes very little to unearth deeper secrets. And maybe that's something that Lynch will continue to dig at, is that like, it's not that you have to dig miles below the surface to find it. Like things are there just below.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what aids in the unsettling and the uncanniness of these characters and of that show, and just of people in general, is that like, all it takes is like just move things slightly askew, and that's when like people's truer natures are revealed.
Yeah.
And Laura Palmer feels very much a symbol of that.
Yeah, and it's what Bobby says at the funeral. Who killed Laura Palmer? We all killed Laura Palmer. We all knew she was in trouble. None of us wanted to see it.
We did nothing. Yeah.
We did nothing.
What a kind of...
Because it was right under the surface, and we just refused to see that. It couldn't be, because it would ruin our idea of America.
Yeah.
All right. Three quick questions then. Cool. First off, okay, we've got eight episodes in this season, 22 episodes next season.
Whew.
Show is then canceled, comes back for a movie, and then gone for over 20 years, and then back for a new season.
Okay.
Will we ever find out who killed Laura Palmer?
I hope so.
All right. Question two, when will we find out who killed Laura Palmer?
Ooh. I want to say optimistically end of season one.
Okay. Third question.
Mm.
Who killed Laura Palmer?
Who killed Laura Palmer? Proximity says one of the parents, based on just who I don't like or who I think is Jacoby and Leo. Those seem to me like easy access emotion wise. Anybody else, I would need a little more story on of like, okay, what's the, like, why? What would be a connection? Leo just...
It's going to blow your mind when you find out it's a law.
Yes! Can't wait for that.
Oh, yeah. Man.
Can't wait.
All right, cool. I wanted to have you talk about it. I hope I didn't... I try to keep my face as still as possible and give you no reactions whatsoever. So enjoy.
I appreciate that. And I wasn't looking at you either. So I just like
good
went off my own space on that one.
So who do you want to talk about?
I will want to mention Audrey Horne and Hawk, actually.
Cool.
I think for me, Audrey is much more, again, I mean, you can say this about a lot of the Twin Peaks characters, but she is much more than she lets on. on the surface, she sounds or kind of gives the impression of like a kind of Lolita, like very heavy flirt, but also someone who's very observant and very much aware of people's deceptions and aware that people are putting on airs. And maybe that's like, that's one of Audrey's strengths, is that she calls out people on their BS or on their like pretend lives. And so
how do you feel about the fact that you have a crush on a high school girl? Like, is that okay with you, or are you working through that?
I'm okay with the fact that all of the high schoolers look like graduate students in this.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Thank goodness.
It's just like, this is the oldest high, this is like Greece, where you have Stockard Channing playing a high schooler. That's my.
I imagine that's part of Lynch's nostalgia. Mm-hmm. I'm not certain of that, but I like to imagine that that's why he casts such old high school students is just to make it Grease.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
All right. So, what about Hawk?
Yeah, Hawk. I really, actually, like what made me appreciate Hawk was the conversation at the end of Rest in Pain. He and Cooper share a beer. And the notion of multiple selves or multiple souls comes up. And I think Coop asks Hawk like, if he believes in the soul. And Hawk says, multiple. Yeah. And almost kind of like doubles down and like, what, you just believe in one? Like, Hawk goes big. And that's when we're watching Leland dance alone again. Mm-hmm. But just that notion of like, you know, oneself is, while oneself or one soul might die, there's another one out in a darker place or in somewhere else. And so that like feeds the notion of a like an evil or a presence beyond what can be seen.
Yeah.
And I think Hawk is someone who is very much in tune and like comfortable with it.
Yeah.
Like, There's a depth to him as well. Like, I guess what's interesting now that I think about it, within Twin Peaks, like no one experiences something and goes, "That seems pretty strange," if you ask me. Like, no one so far has gone, "Wait a minute, this seems kind of weird." Like, once or twice, I think somebody asks Truman if Cooper knows what he's doing, and just like,
right.
"What? Like, who is this guy again?" But everything else, people are like, well, all right.
Yeah.
we're just going to go with it. Which, again, is like something like that doesn't – it's not a glaring thing, but it is something I'm like looking back like, oh, right. Like, you take it as face value because everybody is taking it at face value. And just like things progress. And so you go, okay, like I'll take it as well. I like people operate in this grand dream and you take it and you go with it. You go, okay, so we're here. And I think it's a really great space so far and a really great story.
That's great. Yeah, it makes the uncanny kind of feel like home.
Yeah.
When everybody else rolls with it.
Nice.
Thank you. So I'm so stoked that you're enjoying this. I'm really glad, because this entire podcast was going to be terrible if it was just dragging you through a show you hate.
Oh my gosh.
So, yeah. I mean, there's more tension, you know, and it's exciting, and we're at each other's throat every episode, but, you know. All right, any themes you wanted to talk about in these episodes we watched?
Mm. I feel like we've really talked about them all right. I mean, the two things for me were just relationships or just, like, the deceptions that we have in relationships, but also how we deceive ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, the nature of people, I feel like we've talked about that a lot. And just, like, dreams in general. I feel like this is not quite an antithesis, but just, like, a different way of approaching dreams to, say, like, Inception, which is a very more, like, formalist.
Right.
Of, like, a dream is something that happens in the mind. And here are, like, that was, like, talking about rules. There were very clear rules in terms of how a dream operates.
Here's a flow chart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that was like, okay, well, that's a way to engage with dreamscape. Like, where Twin Peaks is just like, it's just kind of like you enter this space, and like you said, there are some rituals that are very important, but you're not going to be totally explained why.
Yeah.
Or you're not going to be like, there's enough respect not to spoon feed you and to just like, whatever you conjure when you see Hawk standing with a bucket of rocks and oven mittens, I'm just like, okay, cool. Or like, I hear 60 feet, 6 inches and think baseball.
Yeah.
Like, I'm guaranteed not everybody knows that it's 60 feet, six inches from the mound to home plate.
I know that. I'm a big baseball fan. I've got an MLB package. It didn't click until you said it. And I was like, oh, duh. That's right. Exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
Somehow totally missed it.
So I appreciate the, I think it's a brave approach to dreams. And like you said, just allowing that notion of the universe writing the story makes for me complete sense. Especially feeling now that with the intro of the Bookhouse Boys, of a larger mythos, that like we're going to start moving beyond perhaps a centralized mystery.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, I think that gets us out of here. Thanks again for joining us on What Exactly Am I Watching Here? For next week, we're going to be finishing off season one. So, Dom, I'm going to have to ask you to stop at the end of season one, no matter how badly you may want to continue binging, because it is a season finale, and those tend to give you some cliffhangers where you want to jump onto the next season right away. But I want to get you fresh. I want to get you where you are just as confused and lost as everyone else was. Perfect. When they had to wait a full year.
Oh.
And luckily you won't have to.
Good.
So go watch.
That podcast would take forever.
Yeah, that'd be the worst. So go watch those episodes. We'll see you in 60 feet, 6 inches, give or take.
All right.
You can get a hold of us on Twitter, where our handle is @OverthinkPod, and find more at overthinkpod.com. We'll catch you on the flip side.
All right, Dan. We'll talk to you later.